My name's Robert, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you very much, John, for inviting me here. Laura, happy birthday, and to Dave, and what was your first? Raul. I'm really glad you guys are here. I'm going to just say this one little phrase. It's in the Bible, and I'm not a Bible thumper, so don't get scared. But it says all things work together for good, and I'm going to say what that means to me as we go through this, because I think it's for me it's meant a lot. And I'm going to start off by telling you about my fifth birthday. When I was 5 years old, I lived in Huntington Beach with my mother and my stepfather, and my mother was one of the kindest, most interesting people that I had ever met. She was super smart, very artistic, played the piano, took us to the beach every day, like the perfect mother. And for my fifth birthday, I was there. I remember being in the kitchen in our house, and the sun was coming through, and my grandmother was there, and my aunt was there. My mother made me a rocking horse cake and came out like this. And I remember just sitting there going, oh, my God, this is heaven. You know, I'm like, this is like the best. And my life up until seven was like that. I mean, there was a few little things. I was kind of a histrionic kid. You know, for some reason I could fly off the handle for some reason. I still have no idea why I would do that, but I did. But I lived a really good life. My brother was 2 years older than me. He did great stuff. Like, he carved my name into the piano, the grand piano, my mother said. And my mother asked me, Robert, did you do this? And I go, and she goes, Ken, did you do this? And he goes, no. And she goes, he can't write his name yet, you know. But he also did a great thing, because my mother, I used to rat out my brother all the time. She goes, if you keep doing that, I'm going to make a tattletale and pin it on you. And she did. She made a tattletale out of stockings and braided it together, a nice long tattletale. And, of course, it took me like 5 minutes to rat out my brother again. And she pinned it on me, and my mother said, okay, we're going to the store. And I'm like, dude, I was so mortified that I had to wear this thing. And as I was getting out of the car, I was like in tears, and my big brother came up and grabbed the thing and stuffed it down my pants and pulled my shirt out so nobody could see it. And so he was a pretty good big brother. And so I lived a really good life. When I was seven, I went on a bike ride to some place, I don't even remember what it was, with some neighborhood kids, and I got a thorn in my bicycle tire, and it popped, and the kids just left me, and I was 7 years old. And I think it was like a mile or 2 miles, or who knows how far we were from our house, but it seemed like a really long distance. And I stopped at a gas station and said, hey, can you guys help me fix the tire? And instead of fixing the tire, they called the police. And the police came, and they took me to like social services or something, and they put me in a room. And then a little while later, my brother showed up, and we were in there for like 4 or 5 days. And we're like, what is going on? Well, it turned out that, you know, they did an investigation, I guess, in those days. And it turned out that my mother had tuberculosis, and she was very sick. And in those days, when somebody had tuberculosis, they put you in a sanitarium, they called them. And the only way to treat tuberculosis was rest. And that's what you did. They take you to you didn't do any work, you laid in the sun, they fed you well, and that was it. So we didn't see our mother for 2 years. And my brother was always pissed at me because, you know, he thought it was my fault. And, it started this whole ball and chain thing. And we ended up going to foster care. And later on, I found out my mother told me that my real father I never lived with him that I remember. I think my parents divorced when I was like less than 1 year old. And I had a step, my mother remarried, and I had a decent stepfather. But anyway, my father found out that we were in a foster care, and he tried to sue my mother to get custody, and so we ended up going with my grandmother. And my grandmother was a wonderful woman, but she was an alcoholic, and she would drink every day, and I didn't think that much of it. Just to go back, when I was at that, real quick, to tell you how I've got an addictive personality, my mother and my grandmother, they smoked, and I kept bugging them. I was like five. I want a cigarette, you know, let me try a cigarette. I want to smoke. And I think they finally, just to shut me up, they gave me a cigarette. And I killed the whole thing. And I said, can I have another one? And they're like, no, you can't. So I think I started out with a very addictive personality. Anyway, when I turned 9, my mother finally was well enough to come home. She had a lung removed and part of another one. And unfortunately, a few months after, I don't know how long it was, to be honest with you, she passed away in her sleep. And I used to sleep with her a lot, you know. I was the youngest, and I was a mama's boy, and you know, I'd always go and I'd fall asleep in my room, but I'd wake up, and I'd go sleep with her. And I tried to wake her up, and she wouldn't wake up, and I woke up again a few hours later, tried to wake her up. She wouldn't wake up. In the morning, she wouldn't wake up. And I noticed something different, but I was too, you know, we didn't have 911 back then, you know. And so I didn't know what to do. So anyway, I went into my room with my brother. And then my aunt came, and later police came and told us that our mother had passed away. And so, you know, it's one of those things that we were so broken already, because my stepfather actually left my mother when she got sick and left us. And my brother and I were just totally broken kids, and all the crap that we went through. And then we went to live with my father. And my father he was a Navy guy, he was a chief. And any of you guys that are in the Navy, you know, chiefs can be kind of rough guys, you know, and he was a rough guy. He taught me two major lessons in life. One was how to work really hard, and two was how to duck. And and he was a very physically and emotionally violent person. And he used to tell me all kinds of terrible things about my mother. And my mother, I remember when she came back from the sanitarium, I asked her one time, because I didn't have a father figure, and I asked her, you know, how come you divorced my father? And she had never spoken ill of my father. And she goes, I was tired of having phones ripped out the wall and plates thrown. And I didn't even know what to think of that at the time. But anyway, my brother and I were just damaged. Now when my mother died and we went to my grandmother's house for a short period of time, he would not come out of the room. And I went in and I asked him, Ken, you know, what's going on? And he said to me, now we have to be perfect for mom. And that guy got straight A's in through all his schooling. He's got two master's degree, became a math teacher at a high school, and a really very successful football coach. And he's still one of the most disciplined, most organized guys I know. I on the other hand could not get it together. I was just shattered. And with the violence that was happening in our home, the first Christmas we had with my stepmother and my father, my stepmother got really drunk and my father was slamming doors, and the next thing you know, I caught him making out with the neighbor lady on Christmas. And you know, and I never used that against him. I still regret not doing that. But that's one regret I can't let go of. When I was 13, I think, my neighbors or some friends of mine had some beer. And they gave me like it was a tall boy. I don't know if it was Bud or Coors or whatever. And I drank that, and I drank another one, and I got super drunk, and I puked, and it was a total mess at their house. And my father was calling them saying, "I want him home. I want him home." And they're saying, "Oh, he's on his way." And when I got home, my dad knew that I had been drinking, and he started kicking my ass. And I remember, not to, hopefully this doesn't trigger anybody, but I was in the closet trying to block his punches. And all I could think of was about, I can't wait to go drink again. Because it was the first time since all the crap started that I felt some ease and comfort. It was the very first time. And from that moment, I now recognize that I was an alcoholic. And eventually, and that actually took place here in Chula Vista. We moved down here for sixth grade through high school. I went to Hilltop High School, graduated in 1977. And by the way, John asked me to let you know my sobriety date is March 5th, 2008. And so anyway, because though I was drinking and smoking pot and surfing as much as I could and doing anything I could except responsibility, I did leave my father's house because he would beat me too much, and I lived with some neighbors from when I was 15 to 17, and then when I was 17, I moved to Pacific Beach, and right on the boardwalk behind Crystal Pier on the south side, in the condominium, four-story condominium, a woman and her husband, the gentleman had multiple sclerosis, and she had a bad back. They hired me. I lived right there, man. I could look out and see the surf. I surfed every morning, and I would come back and help the guy do exercises and get him out of bed, put him in his wheelchair, and then at night. And then I enrolled at Mesa College and flunked beginning volleyball. I'm not really sure how I did that. But I was just smoking pot and started drinking like crazy and got in all kinds of terrible trouble. My first time I ever went to jail, I think I was like 18, I was walking down the boardwalk and a police officer had a guitar, or he was walking with a guitar he had confiscated from somebody. And I said, "Hey, nice guitar." And he goes, "Come here." And I'm like, "Whoa, no, what did I do?" And they threw me in the police car. I'm like, "Man, my dad's a judge and you're going to get in trouble." And I'm just like this. They took me behind the store there on Garnett and pulled me out and punched the shit out of me, threw me back in the car, and then took me down to the jail. And I got out the next morning, no charges, no nothing. But that was my introduction to jail. And so it didn't kill me. And so I didn't learn anything, is the point. The second big time I went to jail was... I was on the boardwalk, or close to the boardwalk on Diamond Street there in Pacific Beach, and I was with two of my buddies, and they were totally drunk, and I was really drunk, and they were tossing dirt clods off the cliff, the bluff, down at these girls that were laying out. And I actually was not tossing dirt clods. I was just, the head was wobbling and stuff. And next thing you know, a lifeguards came up in a Jeep and stopped and ran up the hill, and they took off, and I could not run. And I got thrown in jail, and I was charged with assault with a deadly weapon against a peace officer. And so basically they said, "Yeah, because you were throwing rocks at lifeguards." And I spent like 5 days in the felony tank, and I was really young, and it was like, but unfortunately I still didn't learn anything. And I got out. They eventually lowered it to like disturbing the peace or something like that. But I kept up with the BS, and I ended up eventually, after taking things that weren't mine, I ended up in Chino State Prison. And I think I was 20 or something. And I went to my first AA meeting. And I went to Chino State Prison on what they called a 90-day observation. And so they sent you there, and they wanted to see if you were real prison material and how you acted, and then you go back to the judge, and the judge says, okay, you go to prison or you go get out on probation. So I had the bright idea, I'm going to tell them I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to go to these AA meetings. And so I was sitting in the back of these AA meetings in the prison, and it's like you couldn't even see the people that were speaking because there was so much smoke. And I'm sitting back there, and I'm going, these are the dumbest son of a bitches I've ever seen in my life. They're just talking complete, total nonsense. And so the moral of that one is if you're here tonight and you're thinking, oh, yeah, this is a good place to be, I like what they have to say, then you're in the right place. If you're like me and you're sitting there going, these are the dumbest son of a bitches I've ever met, you're in the right place too. and because you don't come in these doors for no reason, right? I still didn't learn anything. And so I was totally unemployable. I started dealing drugs. I ended up violating probation. I was looking at doing a couple of years in state prison. And instead of standing up and taking it like a man, I ran. And I went to Mexico, and I went to a place called San Blas, where they have 5 right-hand point breaks, really good surfing, and a left-hand point break of 20 kilometers away. And I started trafficking drugs down there. My job was to go up into the mountains and ride a mule, and have a bunch of mules behind me and with some guys, local guys, and we would go by, you know, we'd get together a load of pot to put in a clandestine airport and send it off. And I would always get in Tequila, Jalisco, which is a town between Tepic and Guadalajara. We would go by there and I'd get a 5-liter jug of tequila, because if you've never ridden a horse or a mule for a long period of time, it hurts. And so I wouldn't get drunk while I was on working, but I would drink a shot like every hour or two just for the saddle wounds, supposedly. Eventually I got arrested again in Tijuana, and I got locked up. And I went to La Mesa prison, they call Pueblito La Mesa. And it was a very interesting place on this earth at that time. There was kids in there. You could have your wife in there or your girlfriend. There was a men's section and a women's section, but the women went over to the men and the men went over to the women's. Anything you could have that you wanted if you could pay for it. They didn't give you a place to sleep. They did give you 2 meals a day, which was very subpar, if I do say myself. But they no toothbrush, no nothing. So you had to fend for yourself. They even charged you to count you. You had to pay the guards every time they came to count you. And if you didn't, then you had to work for the prison in the trash heap, in the sewers, in the kitchen or whatever. So I didn't like any of that type of work, so I kept slinging drugs inside the prison. And I knew some of the narcos that were in there because I was involved in it in southern Mexico. And I ended up making money at times, you know, because I knew people that needed drugs in the States, and they had drugs in the States, and I made those connections. I sold coke inside there. I built a still. I made Pruno, and I made alcohol, and you know, I mean, I was kind of popular for a while, but I also ended up getting my ass kicked a lot, after about 4 years of this, I started to question myself, like, what am I doing here? And I'd see these guys out on the yard. We called them the brothers. They were the holy roller types, and they're waving their hands. And I just said to myself, you know, I'd like to feel that, what it is they're doing. I just would love to know what that is. And so I was doing cocaine, and I was reading the Bible, and I read the whole Bible from front to cover, Old Testament, New Testament. And it was the most bizarre, violent, very weird thing I'd ever read. But eventually there was a hunger strike that started in the prison, because people, if you didn't have any money, you had to do your whole sentence. I was sentenced to 8 years and 4 months, and you had to do the whole thing. You didn't get paroled, or early release, as they called it. And but the narcos all got out early, and the rich people all got out early. So there was a hunger strike amongst the prisoners, and I said, well, that sounds like a good idea to me. And so I started that hunger strike, and in the first 30, 40 days, the first 30 days, I didn't eat because I was doing coke. And of course, I got extremely sick. I got sepsis. And they took me to the prison infirmary, and I was near death, but I wouldn't eat. And in this prison, though, I met somebody in there that changed my life forever. Her name was Sister Antonia Brenner, known as the prison angel. And she lived in that prison for over 30 years, and she would minister to me. And she told me, you know, she took me one time, she goes, I want you to go back to that little six-year-old boy and ask yourself, did that six-year-old boy deserve what had happened to him? And she tried to get me to look at that boy and remember that I was that boy. I still have in my phone every day, I've got a little thing that goes off that says boy, and it helps me remember that. And she taught me just about everything. But she used to come, when I was in an infirmary, I refused to eat. And I told her, she would come in and say, you know, you can't do this, you know, and you just can't do this. And I said, look, mother, I'm tired. I'm done. I just want to check out. I can't do it anymore. I've been here too long. I've got no hope. I'm a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. I'm never going to get out of here alive. And so I'm going to go out on my own terms. And she just every day would come in. And finally, one day, she said something, and I won't bore you with the whole story, but she said something to me that made me say, wait, okay. And I started eating again. And I sat there and I was thinking to myself, why am I here? My brother went through everything I did, and yet he's got a home and kids and a life, and you know, why am I here? And at some point it dawned on me, I was here not because of what happened to me, I was here because of the decisions I had been making. And that, talk about spiritual awakenings, that woke me up, because I realized that if I was responsible for being here, maybe I could be responsible for hopefully someday getting out and maybe never coming back. And I started working with Sister Antonia once I got better. I started helping her. She had food and clothes and medicine and things, and I started working and helping with her all the time. And I discovered the joy of service. And in doing so, I finally started to feel some worth. And but then one night, I broke down and I went and got some coke. And I did the coke, and this wave of shame came over me. And I fell to my knees and I said, God, get me out of here. I can't do this anymore. I don't have it in me. I'm done. And the next day, they called me into the warden's office and they said, you're getting out tomorrow, Thanksgiving. And I was like, oh my God, you can't, are you lying to me or what? And Sister was there, and the warden, by this time I had kind of known him, and they liked what the work I was doing, and I couldn't even believe it. But a year or so before this, a federal marshal from the United States came to the prison and said, hey, your name is Robert Cass, it's not Richard Cass, like you've been telling everybody. And I go, nah, you don't know what you're talking about. But he left his card with me. Because I owed time in the States. And so I pulled that card out and I called the guy collect. He took the call and I said, listen, I'm getting out tomorrow and I'm going to walk across the border and I'll turn myself into you under one condition. And he goes, well, what's that? And I said, there's a McDonald's right there in San Ysidro. And if you buy me a Big Mac, a milk, and a milkshake, and fries, I'll turn myself in. He goes, deal. And the guy did it. He actually did it. And he handcuffed me in front so I could eat it. And when we got to the medical, or when we got to MCC, the federal jail downtown, he got in trouble because he had me handcuffed. But I spent 6 months in, I was in my own solitary little room. It was like on the 12th, or it was, I think, the 8th floor or the 11th floor, which was like 22 stories in this thing. And I could see Mexico, I could see the Pacific. And what I needed, because I was so physically ragdolled, I needed that. And I spent 6 months in there while I was going through the court process. And I spent 23 hours a day in this room. I read, I studied, and I got somewhere emotionally. They eventually transferred me to someplace in Texas, Three Rivers, Texas, a brand new prison. I saw some violence there, and all of a sudden I crashed. And what it was I didn't know it at the time, but it was PTSD. And I completely just unraveled. And they sent me to the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. And I ended up not doing well there for a while, and they sent me to the psychiatric hole. So I was basically what I considered at the time at the end of the earth, the darkest place you could possibly be. But somehow I started to get better. I was taking medicine. I started working with this guy that was blinded himself, this psychiatric patient. Eventually, they let me out of the psychiatric unit. I became a hospital orderly, and I joined a volunteer hospice group, and where we counseled dying inmates. And it was one of the I swear to God, it was a spiritual experience. I mean, I said, I'm going to be a nurse. And eventually I got out of there. They brought me back to California to serve some state time, which had really already expired, but they didn't get the memo, I guess, that my time was up. And so they took me to Folsom, and then to Chino again, and then down here to Donovan, and they let me out. And and this was in 1991. And I ended up going. I got on the trolley, which I had never seen, and I got off at. I saw this thing called Volunteers of America, which is downtown on 12th and Imperial or something, or 12th and Imperial, I think, something like that. And so I got off the thing and I walked up and I said, look, I just got out of prison. I've been in there for 6 years, you know, total, and I'm lost. And they go, well, this is a detox. And I go, okay. So I panicked and I called this friend of mine that was still in the business, the bad business. And he came and got me, took me to his house. He made me a steak, and the next day we went surfing, and he put me up in his little little trailer in this yard that he had, and I stayed there a couple of days, and I go, I can't do this. I got to do the right thing, and I called Sister Antonia, and she was very good friends with Father Joe, and so they put me in the Joan Crock Center, and I eventually started working at Salvation Army and at Episcopal Community Services, doing, you know, shelter work type stuff, and I was volunteering doing the new resident orientation there at the Joan Crock Center at the St. Vincent de Paul, and a job came available, a good job, and I got that, and I worked there for 4 years. And in towards the end of that 4 years, I met a really nice young lady, and I met her because I opened up this 350-bed rehabilitation center. It's called the Paul Mirabli Center. It's down there at 15th and Imperial, And at those days, it was brand new and super sparkly. I wrote the software to run the place, and I didn't really realize it at the time, but it was kind of like a hospital system. And I ran it for a year, and then I did another job for them, and then I kind of burned out on that. And but I met this I met some people from San Diego County Tuberculosis Control Office in my work. And I think it was 94, I ran the inclement weather shelter at Balboa Park Gymnasium. And so we had 700 beds there. And one of this lady from the county came and said, hey, we want to do tuberculosis screening here. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, you have other services, right? You know, and she goes, yeah. And I go, let's do a healthcare fair for the homeless. Let's make it a 3-day thing. And so we did that. And on the days that this started coming, this young lady came, and she was actually not in TB control. She was in STD control. And she starts harping on me about wanting to hand out condoms and birth control stuff. And I go, wait, Father Joe's not going to do that, you know? And he was very conservative, if you will. And so anyway, it turns out I lived in this place in Pacific Beach, and one day I walked into the laundry room and I startled this poor young lady, and it turns out to be the same one. Her name is Annie. And this year we're going to be married for 30 years. Wow. Yeah, 30 years. Yeah. Obviously there's something very wrong with her, you know, but anyway, we have two kids, and I have my, actually, when I was in San Blas, I had a girlfriend that, I have a 38-year-old son who's in the program, so having your kid here is pretty special, I know, because I was fortunate enough to have mine at one of these. But anyway, what happened, though, was after I went to school for 5 years to become a nurse, and later on, fast forward years, in 2008, I started a company, a medical software company, and I was in March of 2008, I was in Chicago on a business meeting, and the guy, the vice president of the company I was meeting with, turned out to be an alcoholic too. And so we had a really nice dinner meeting where we got totally drunk and started arguing, and his staff was like, oh, and the guy that came with me, also an alcoholic, you know, he was like, oh, let's get out of here. I said, let's go get in a cab and go to the worst, you know, dive bar we can find, right? You know, so they take us to the Redhead Piano Bar in Chicago, Illinois, and we just get totally drunk. And at the end of the night, I see this guy and this gal hanging out at the bar, and I look over. My buddy's got his head on the table, and there's nobody else in the place. And so I walked up and I go, "Hey, what's going on?" The guy goes, "Hey, just fuck you, you know, get the fuck away, you know, and all this stuff." And I go, wait, man, I'm just a friendly drunk. And next thing you know, a bouncer came and grabbed me. And when he grabbed me, I thought it was a smart idea to reach over him and grab the guy that was yelling at me by his hair. And so they dragged me out. He drags me out, and I got this guy by the hair. And I end up in the drunk tank, to make a long story short. And that was like 16 or 17 years from when I got out. And I was just like, I swore I would never do this. And I put my head in my hands and I go, I'm an alcoholic. I finally admitted it. And, you know, I had quit drinking when I got out of prison the first time. I didn't drink for a year because I was afraid I would use cocaine. I thought I was really, cocaine was my biggest problem. Then my wife told me one time, don't drink. And I didn't do that for 2.5 years. And then another time I quit for 4.5 years. And every time I convinced myself that I could do it, because I had done so well over the last several years that, but each time I drank again, I crashed quicker. It's like they say, it's a progressive disease even if you're not drinking, and it certainly was for me. And so after that trip, my wife told me, and I had to call her and said, look, this is what happened. And she was like, okay. She goes, I'm taking the kids, I found an apartment. We're gone. She goes, you go to AA? Maybe I'll stay. And so I said, I'm going to AA. I met Michael and Bill and some other guys around here. And I went to a meeting, and the first meeting I went to, this guy says, oh, I got 4 years. He got 4 years. And I go, how the hell did you do that? How is that possible? And it turns out, it's funny, that it's one day at a time, right? We work, read the book, work the steps, get a sponsor, help others. You know, it works. Anyway, how do I stay sober? I stay sober by going to meetings and doing this stuff. But mostly, one of the other things that helps me a lot whenever I'm feeling crushing, and I don't feel a crushing need to drink. As a matter of fact, I feel like I know I can't drink. But it's steps 1, 2, and 3 for me. You know, alcohol is a power greater than me. It kicks my ass. Always has, there's no doubt. I need a power greater than alcohol to help me. And number 3 is, what is my choice going to be, right? And I choose not to drink anymore because I got too many people that care about me. And I also, I would like to say I love myself, but Bill knows I'm self-deprecate a bit. But I have come some ways. And I didn't mention, but I did go to nursing school, or maybe I did mention, but I became a nurse, and I worked in the burn ICU, and I took care of very, very sick people. I've worked hospice, and it ain't bad. And so the point is that I think when they tell us to make coffee when we first get here, or clean the dishes, or do anything, that is the start of service. That'll make your life manageable. It'll change your outlook. You're no longer harming the world. You're no longer damaging the world or yourself. You're helping others, which helps you, helps me. It's the only thing that keeps me out of trouble. And what I want to close with is that I said at the beginning, all things work together for good. You know, I'm not going to do it. He said, I'm going to cry. My mother died. It was horrible. My father beat me. That was horrible. I was an alcoholic and a drug addict and went to prison. All that was horrible. But you know what? I've sat with people that are dying, and I understand the pain of the family and the person. I've sat with alcoholics, and I know what they're going through. These things that we've gone through, this is actually our strength. All things do actually work together for good. We take the pain that we've caused and experienced, and we share it, the opposite of it. We turn it into love, and we share it. And you know what? It's a magical thing. It's absolutely magical. We're kind of like experts in suffering, you know? We're experts. We have a lot to offer. You know, some of the best alcohol and drug counselors are alcohol and drug addicts, right? And so what I want to say, end with, is that, you know, we have an opportunity to really help change the world one person at a time, one thing at a time, one little way at a time. We were just talking, John and I, about, you know, I saw when I was driving on my way here by 8 underneath the freeway was a homeless encampment. And I said, you know, they really ought to clear those guys out. And then the next thought, I was actually listening to a Sister Antonia tape, and the next thought, I go, wait, what would she have me do? And so I said a prayer for them. And so if you see somebody that that's homeless, hurt, drug and alcohol addicted, somebody that you does something that you don't like, what I do is I try to say a prayer for them. I don't do it always. Sometimes I yell, get the fuck out of the way, you know, or you know, do something. But anyway, it's been a real, I almost feel like I'm coming home because I lived in Chula Vista for a while. John, thank you very much. And I appreciate you guys. And I wish you all the best in everything you do. Thanks.
Let's thank Robert one more time. Thank you, Robert. The ex-problem drinker armed with the facts about himself, right? After the meeting, Robert will be up here behind the podium. You can come up and shake his hand and thank him for sharing tonight. I would like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner.